scepter of power grasped in his right hand, and trailed by a cortege of 8 slayers, Shimra marched into the Hall of Convergence, his legs propelling him in such long strides that Anami was compelled to run to keep up. Alerted to his approach, everyone present in the vaulted chamber, Nomanor included, had already assumed attitudes of obeisance.
"Why was I summoned from my meditation with the gods?"
Shimra demanded of no one in particular.
"Is my role in our final campaign less than yours, Supreme Commander Loait?"
Loait remained in genuflection.
"Supreme One, the War Master bade that I seek audience with you as soon as you would permit."
"Is War Master Nazchoka's inactivity such that he can find time to communicate with the likes of you?"
"Dreadlord, the War Master had been anything but idle," Loait said with a hint of exasperation. "Engaged at Muscave, his forces overwhelmed those of our enemy. Thus was he able to dispatch to Zonama Sikat a task force that escorts and safeguards the ailing vessel that is our secret weapon."
Shimra made a fatigued sound.
"I need to hear this from your mouth, Supreme Commander. Did I not just say that your urgent entreaty found me deep in rapport with the gods?"
Loait snapped his fists to his shoulders in salute.
"I beg forgiveness, Great One. Then assuredly you already know that Zonama Sikat appeared to be undefended, save for a handful of enemy fighters."
"Assuredly."
"And that the task force commander dispatched coral skippers to engage those fighters."
"What of it?"
Shimra said heatedly.
"Would you hold me prisoner here with your pointless statements?"
Again Loait snapped his fists.
"Of course the gods told you, Lord, that the coral skippers have met with resistance from living vessels."
Shimra came to an abrupt halt and stared at the Supreme Commander.
"Dread Lord,"
Anami said, as if to prompt a response.
"Living vessels, you say?"
Shimra said finally. Loait nodded in acknowledgement. Shimra pointed to the hall's villip choir.
"I would see an image of these living vessels."
Shortly, a ghostly image appeared, showing a vessel forged of smooth rocks, dimpled with plasma launchers and dove-in basal emplacements. Shimra swung to Loait.
"Why hasn't the War Master ordered the Domain Commander to bring his capital vessels to bear on Zonama Sikat?"
"The War Master wishes to do just that, God Chosen. He merely awaits your sanction for such an action."
Shimra said nothing.
"There is more, Lord,"
a second seer said.
"Several enemy ships have outwitted our Dovin basal voids and found their way to the surface of Yuuzhan'tar. Even now, our primary landing field is threatened."
Shimra seemed to shake himself out of his daze.
"Need I remind any of you that I have looked deeply into the Eighth Cortex and conversed with Yun'Harla herself on these matters?"
The chief seer nodded.
"We bear that in mind, Great One, and ask only for elucidation. Could the ancient prophecies and revelations be wrong? Could they have been misinterpreted? Is it possible that the gods have not engineered the living vessels as an additional test, but in fact have aligned themselves with the Jedi?"
Shimra's eyes flared like Nova's.
"Heresy! Heresy! Here in my very house!"
He aimed the scepter at the seers.
"You buffoons have outlived your usefulness."
He whirled to the slayers.
"Rid me of them."
A pair of slayers uncoiled their amphistaffs and advanced on the female quartet with deadly purpose. The seers offered no resistance, raising faces and extending their thin necks for the stiffened weapons. The slayers wasted no motions in decapitating them. One of the severed heads was still rolling across the floor when a herald entered the hall.
"Great Lord, High Priest Jaqen, Master Shaper Kilaquad, and High Prefect Rathul request audience."
Shimra went to his throne and sat.
"By all means, bid them enter, herald."
The elite trio entered in a rush, but lost some of their momentum on seeing the 4 headless corpses. Shimra smiled faintly.
"They had the audacity to doubt my interpretation of the revelation."
His expression darkened.
Be attentive to their present circumstance when you state your concerns.
We have no concerns, Dreadlord, Drathul said, clearly improvising. On learning of the War Master's report of living ships, we came to offer you praise for your foresight. The Yuuzhan Vong are escalated by the gods' willingness to present us with even greater challenges.
You hastened here to tell me that?
Shimra asked. One question, Lord, Jaqen said. Have the gods furnished these ships to the Alliance, or do the ships originate from the living world itself? Shimra gestured in an offhand way to Nomanor.
Answer him, Prefect, since you are our leading expert on Zonama Seacot.
Supreme One, I know only what I hear from spies among the heretics, but I suspect that there are no living ships.
Nomanor grew emboldened as he continued.
Instead, I propose that our Coral Skipper pilots have fallen victim to Jedi mind tricks.
Drathul gestured angrily to the Villip image of the living ship.
You dismiss that as a Jedi mind trick?
Shimra grinned maniacally.
Answer your superior, Prefect Nomanor.
Nomanor straightened his shoulders.
Why not? We know that they are capable of projecting false images and putting words in the mouths of those they would manipulate. We also know that they have successfully confused our Yamasks in the past.
Shimra spoke before Drathul could argue the point.
Prefect Nomanor is to be admired for his inventiveness. But in fact, the vessel our villagers show us is no mind trick. In answer to High Priest Jaqen's question, the gods have tutored the living planet in the creation of these monstrosities. But the Jedi are not responsible. It is the heretics who have brought this latest test upon us. The gods have no desire to award us this galaxy, while heretics and shamed ones walk freely among us.
He turned to the commander of the Slayers.
Half the Citadel garrison of warriors is to be placed at the right hand of Prefect Nomanor. He will lead them against the heretics and the shamed ones. Not one of them is to be left alive.
A human soldier wrapped the knuckles of his gloved hand against the circular viewport of Jag's inverted clockcraft.
Hang on a minute, Flyboy, he yelled.
All at once, the access hatch above, or under, Jag's head opened, and several pairs of hands were reaching inside the cockpit to release him from the crash webbing that secured him to the seat.
Down you go,
the same one who had rapped on the viewport said. Jag allowed himself to descend into the upraised hands of his rescuers, and to continue to be supported by them while he was planted on his feet. With the world spinning around him, and the blood that had gathered in his head draining back to where it belonged. Someone removed Jag's helmet and put the mouth of a canteen to his lips. When the long moment of dizziness had passed, he saw that the clockcraft, missing three of its sweeping talon-shaped solar array panels, had crashed upside down in a copse of tangled fruit-bearing trees that rose from the middle of an oozy villa paddy. The soldiers around him wore jet backpacks, holo-transceiving helmets, and combat biosuits.
Is he hurt?
Someone asked, loud enough to be heard over the tumult. Jag recognized the lined face of Captain Judder Page under the camouflage cosmetic. Jag patted himself down.
I'm unharmed.
Page stuck out his hand.
I'm Captain.
I know who you are, Jag said. Thank you for coming to my aid. Page shrugged off the gratitude.
Captain Page,
a young Bothan interrupted.
We've made contact with the indigenous force.
Jag, Page, and the pair of Wraith Squadron intelligence operatives turned to see four Yuuzhan Vong males being ushered through the perimeter. The humanoids were scarcely scarred, compared to most of the Yuuzhan Vong warriors Jag had seen, but all had pronounced deformities, some of the face, others of the limbs. Shamed ones, he thought. The tallest and most deformed of the four executed a facsimile of an Alliance salute.
Take us to your leaders, he said in Basic. As if by rote.
Garrick Lauren and Kel Tanner exchanged skeptical glances.
Who taught you to say that?
Lauren asked.
I did,
someone answered,
in a clipped Coruscanti accent, as the same shamed one was pressing his forefinger to his ear, presumably to adjust the fit of a translating Tizo worm. A tall, lean, dark-haired human appeared from the trees, beaming at the two wraiths. Jag was familiar with the name Baljus Arnjak. With him walked a thin but dashing-looking middle-aged man, with reddish hair, bright even teeth, and deeply tanned skin. Smiling broadly, Paige immediately shook hands with the man, then pulled him into a mutually backslapping embrace.
"I always figured you'd survive," Paige said, when the two had stepped away from each other.
The handsome man motioned to the four Yuuzhan Vong.
"Thanks to them, I did.
Their heretic group rescued me and a bunch of others from what would have been some serious bloodletting at one of the temples." Paige turned to Jag.
"Fell, meet Major Pash Kraken."
Jag nodded in greeting. Coruscant was suddenly starting to feel like the veterans' home.
"The fires are Shimra's doing," Harar said. "The Supreme Overlord has asked the World Brain to set Yuuzhan Tar ablaze, to prevent anyone from occupying it."
The priest sounded despondent.
"Shimra wouldn't have done this unless he fears defeat. Either that, or the proximity of Zonama Seacott has deranged him."
"Whether he's desperate or mad, we have him on the run," Han said elated.
Harar gazed at those around him. Judging by the nods of agreement, the always entertaining and sometimes perplexing Han Solo was expressing the sentiment of everyone gathered at the landing platform. His wife Leia, Master Luke Skywalker and his wife Mara, the twins Jason and Jaina, Yuuzhan Vong Mark Tahiri, the military-minded Jedi Kenth Hamner, Zonama Seacott's Magister Jabatha, the two numerically named machine intelligences, droids, who sometimes seemed as alive as their makers and owners, and the pair of Nogri, who appeared at once to be bodyguards, familiars, and friends.
"What now?"
Han asked, planting his hands on his hips in a posture of impatience.
"Capturing or killing Shimra may not be enough to save the planet. Actions taken by the World Brain are incontrovertible. Once tasked, it cannot be swayed to alter its plan, even by Shimra."
Harar glanced at the Skywalkers.
"If you are to save your capital world, the Brain too will have to be destroyed."
"You can't do that, Harar," Jason snapped.
Harar looked at the young Jedi.
"Then go to it and persuade it otherwise. That's our job,"
Han said suddenly, reaching for Leia's right hand. With the other Jedi, Magister Jabatha, and the pair of droids gazing at him in sudden alarm, he added,
"Do you think we were just going to give the rest of you a ride there?"
He jerked his thumb at the Millennium Falcon.
"This ship ain't no air taxi."
300 armored warriors, borrowed from the Citadel garrison and on loan to Prefect Noma Noor, raced through the squares and byways of the sacred precinct like an avenging army, putting Kufi and Amphistaff to every heretic and shamed one who hadn't had sense enough to go into hiding, which turned out to be many, hundreds, thousands. Enraptured by the prophesied arrival of Zonama Seacott, certain that thousand-eyed Yun Shuno would guarantee their passage to a beatific afterlife, exulting in their newfound freedom, however short-lived, confident that Shimra and the elite would be overthrown, the heretics were fervent to martyr themselves, ostracized because of physiological defects rather than committed sins, forced to live in the shadow of the unshamed and under the scrutiny of merciless gods, guilty of trespasses they couldn't begin to imagine and would spend the rest of their miserable lives attempting to understand, they had at last embraced their peculiarities and cast their lot with the Jedi. There was simply no holding them back. Gazing down on the place of hierarchy, Noma Noor was struck dumb by the butchery for which he was responsible, thanks to Shimra, and yet was powerless to thwart. It was immediately clear that the warriors had merely been practicing up until this point. For now, trapped in the place of hierarchy, was a crowd into which they could wade like thrashing Byots. But the horror had scarcely commenced, with war cries answered by agonized screams, when fires began to break out in many of the quake-damaged structures that walled the place, including the prefectory and the Temple of the Lovers, Yun Tixin, and Yum Ka. For a moment, Nomanor was certain that the sudden blazes were the result of firebomb strafings by Alliance starfighters that had punched through Coruscant's Dovin basal voids. Quickly, he lifted his gaze. There were too few starfighters in the sky to account for so many fires, and no evidence of orbital bombardment, turbolaser bolts, or proton torpedoes. Then he understood, and his heart filled with such anguish that he dropped to his knees and remained there until he had caught his breath and regained his senses. Shimra was responsible. Nomanor railed and shook his fists at the smoke and ember-filled sky. "I should have killed you when I had the chance!" He struggled to his feet, his expression growing more grave with every centimeter of elevation. At the foot of the broad stairs, he grabbed the tattered robe skin of a slain shamed one, and donning it, began to shoulder his way into the place of hierarchy, ignoring the bloodshed occurring on all sides and aiming for a tall rubble pile at the center of the square. With bodies falling all around him, he scrambled up the pile. There, alone at the summit, he loosed a blood-curdling scream and raised the arm around which the living weapon was curled.
"I am Yusha, the Prophet!"
he yelled at the top of his lungs.
"Our hour is at hand! I will lead you to victory!"
A long moment of stunned silence fell over the place of hierarchy. Then a roar went up from the oppressed, and they surged against the warriors, crude weapons cleaving, black blood streaming and misting into the air, fiery embers cycloning about them like a sacrament from the gods. From 100,000 kilometers out, Coruscant was a vortex of destruction, lanced from all directions by turbo laser bolts, modeled by yawning Dovin basal singularities, lit from within by flaring explosions.
"This party's just the way we left it," Han said, as the Falcon streaked for the embattled galactic center.
"I missed that one, Dad," Jaina said flatly from the co-pilot's chair.
"Me too," Jason said from behind her.
Peripherally, Han saw his son glance at the Yuuzhan Vong priest in the adjacent chair.
"Harar and I were on a worldship over Merkur."
Regretting his facile statement, Han went back to attending to the Falcon's instruments. Jason and an uneasy Harar had taken the cockpit's rear chairs after Leia and Luke had climbed into the quad laser turrets. Mara, Kent, Tahiri, Kakmain, Miwal, and the droids were in the forward compartment. Alliance capital vessels were concentrating fire along the transitor and well into Coruscant's bright side, but the battle was raging planet-wide. A tone sounded from the comm board, and a baritone voice issued from the cockpit annunciators.
"Millennium Falcon, this is Right to Rule Control. Your best insertion point is presently at Bacta Sector 817, but we'll keep you updated on the situation."
Jaina leaned forward to study the tactical display. "Copy that, Right to Rule, and thanks for the help."
"Millennium Falcon, Grand Admiral Pelion wishes you good fortune."
"Tell him the same from us," Han said into the headset mouthpiece. The Falcon was closing on the insertion point when two X-Wings appeared to either side of it.
"Good to see you, Millennium Falcon,"
one of the pilots said over the tactical net.
"Mind if we ride down with you?"
"Who's escorting who?" Jaina asked.
"Let's call it a party of three,"
the other pilot said. The spacecraft that housed the orbital Dovin basals might have been fragments of Coruscant's deliberately smashed moon, but the voids they generated were as large as shockball stadiums. With the X-Wings pressing close, Han sent the Falcon on her starboard side to edge between two gaping shield singularities. The ship wasn't through the strait when a third void yawned.
"Feed that thing something," Jaina said over the net.
The starfighter pilots responded by paying out pairs of proton torpedoes. Instantly warped off course, the glowing orbs were ingested by the gravitic anomaly. With the Dovin basal momentarily distracted, Han called on the sublight drives for a burst of speed and rocketed the Falcon past the maw. Shortly, the Falcon was wending through forested spires that rose east of the sacred precinct. "Homing beacon," Jaina told Han. A map of the Yuuzhan Vong Form governmental district resolved on the terrain following sensor screen. Jaina tapped her forefinger against the pulsing bezel. "That's our rally point." What should have come into view was Mount Umate, highest peak of the Monarai Mountains. But what came into view instead was a massive crater encompassing all of what had once been Monument Plaza. The smoke was denser at the outskirts of the sacred precinct. Eastport, where the Solas had lived and Han had kept the Falcon docked, was a memory. Wherever Han looked, he saw evidence of the incredible damage wrought by ranged weapons and crashed Golan defense platforms, skyhooks, and orbital solar energy transfer satellites. Fires raged on the surface, and smoke billowed into the sky. Through gaps in the clouds, Han could discern crowds of Yuuzhan Vong civilians running every which way in pandemonium. The Falcon raced across the devastated cityscape, then down into blazing chasms and corridors thick with roiling smoke. The landscape was jagged with ferrocrete debris. The remains of superstructures jutted up at odd angles like experimental sculpture. Homing in on the beacon, Han veered the Falcon slightly north and began a slow descent through the smoke. He realized that they were going to be setting down at the western terminus of the Glitani Esplanade, but principally because the map display established as much. Aware of the Falcon's approach, Alliance soldiers began to appear on a spacious sheltered balcony that jutted out over the former promenade and had been secured by commandos for use as a landing zone. Engaging the repulsor lifts, Han steered the ship onto the ledge and let her settle down on her landing gear. Last to file from the cockpit, Han found Leia, Luke, Mara, Tahiri, and Kenth waiting in the ring corridor, already sheathed in biosuits. While Jason and Jaina were slipping into their suits, he palmed the bulkhead switch that extended the entry ramp.
Kakmei! Miwal!
He shouted toward the forward compartment.
You and the droids remain aboard. We're not going to be here long.
Heads ducked, the Jedi landing party scrambled down the ramp. A scorching debris-laden wind was howling across the balcony, tearing at the enviro-suits worn by the soldiers who approached the ship.
Welcome home,
Jutter Page said, shouting to be heard as two A-wings streaked low overhead. Like his comrades, Page was wearing a jetpack and helmet and carrying a blaster rifle. Han wasn't surprised to spy a couple of wraiths among the commando platoon, but Pash Kraken was the last person he had expected to see. Jaina was even more stunned to see Jag Fell, who was waiting with a few others for a shuttle that would convey them to Westport, where there were starfighters that needed pilots. Jaina hurried to Jag, while Paige began to brief Luke, Kenth, Mara, and Jason on the situation planetside. Leia stepped into the howling wind to embrace her brother and Mara, then hugged Jason as if she wasn't going to let him go. She did the same with Jaina, after Jaina had said hello and goodbye to Jag. The living ship, forged from the seed partners to which Kip had bonded, soared soundlessly and effortlessly through Zonama Sikat's tormented sky. In pairs and trios, coral skippers pierced the planet's envelope to attack the vessels the planet itself had fashioned to frustrate them. But so far, none had made it through to the surface. The few that had succeeded in getting past the Jedi pilots had been repelled by Zonama itself. With powerful updrafts or unseen gravity generators that had hurled the skips to the edge of space. Zonama's consciousness was manipulating the Jedi ships into flying with the same unsettling sense of conformity displayed by the flights of coral skippers. Yuuzhan Vong and Jedi ships alike were part of a zigzagging aerial dance that was being choreographed from afar. Over and above what the Alliance had accomplished, it was the Yuuzhan Vong's unswerving subordination to the will of the gods and the importance of captives that had cost them hundreds of vessels and countless lives at Abak Nine, Obroa Sky, and other arenas. As extraordinary as they were as a species, and as warriors, it was foolhardy courage and inflexibility that could end up costing them Zonama Sikat as well. That was assuming that the Jedi would eventually grow comfortable with piloting the Sakotan ships, Kip mused. Merely settling into the pulsing red and green cockpits had required resolve. The canopy was similar to the mica-like transparency of a coral skipper, but, like everything in the cockpit, it was warm to the touch. Comparable to a combination yoke, accelerator, and weapons trigger, the main control had actually reached up and wrapped around his right hand. More important, the ship engaged a pilot's mind in a kind of telepathic dialogue. There was no astromech droid to report on the status of the systems, No cognition hood interface, as on the stolen Yuuzhan Vong vessel that had come to be called Trickster. But the Sokoden ship incorporated some of the qualities of each by speaking telepathically to the pilot. The ship didn't have a voice. It wasn't telepathy on the order of that honed by the Jedi. But Kip could sense what the vessel was feeling and thinking, the way he had been able to sense the feelings of the crazy little seed partners that had clung to him. Kip was beginning to think of them as the Sokoden equivalent of lightsabers. The pilot didn't have to be a Jedi. Flying the ships didn't require a special connection to the Force. But a ship's ability to perform appeared to be directly related to the degree to which a pilot could surrender him or herself, become egoless and empty. Saba, Lobaka, and Tama Jurjamin, whose call signs were Hisser, Streak, and Quiet, respectively, were demonstrating this to be the case. Kip was in awe of the maneuvers they were executing, to the point that he sometimes lost focus on the battle itself. Kip's comlink toned.
Kip, you getting the hang of these things?
Corin Horn asked. The intership comlink transmission was being relayed through Jade Shadow, which was in stationary orbit at the edge of the battle zone, unpiloted, but slave circuit and all countermeasures enabled.
I've been wondering if the ship is having trouble getting the hang of me.
You and me both. I know I'm targeting correctly, but a lot of my shots are going wide, even when there aren't voids standing between me and the target.
Something about Seacott's need for us not to be killers.
Then why are we up here? Just for show?
Maybe it's the same between Seacott and us as between the ships and us. Seacott's still trying to get a feel for us. Once that happens, we'll be able to target more accurately. A sudden darkness had fallen over the Vongform cityscape. Their lightsabers ignited, glowing blue, violet, green. The Jedi drew on the Force to propel them across the fissured and rain-slicked rooftops and balconies that dangled over what was once the Glatani Esplanade. Thanks to their jetpacks, Captain Page's commandos were just managing to keep up. Rain was falling hard and being driven every which way by fierce gusts of wind. Overhead, it was no longer possible to differentiate flashes of lightning from the artificial brilliance of deadly engagements. For Luke, the nebulous nature of the surroundings mirrored his inner state. The quickest route is through the North Concourse, Mara told Judder Page, when everyone had come to a halt on a puddled ledge. Mara was leading the combined teams from memory, though also relying on Jason and Tahiri's Vong sense to keep everyone from encountering patrols of Yuuzhan Vong warriors. Page had his gaze fixed on the water-beaded display of a positioning unit built into the sleeve of his biosuit. According to this, there was bridge access to the concourse. Mara nodded. The Bridge of Unity. I used to have lunch in the restaurant on the lower level. 15 minutes of flat-out running brought them to the Bridge of Unity, which had lost the ornamental wirework and inscribed plaques that had earned it landmark status. Now the bridge was little more than a ferrocrete slab spanning the Esplanade Canyon. From the bridge's southern abutment, the Jedi had their first unobstructed view of their objective. Several kilometers to the east, illuminated by forking lightning and accented by the laser beams of circling starfighters, Shimra Citadel towered above the infernal landscape. The Citadel's base was lost in swirls of dark smoke, but halfway to the rounded summit, four walkways approached from separate directions, linking the Citadel to surrounding structures. A resonant bellowing issued from the far side of the bridge, and two huge eyes stood out in the gloom. As if under strobing light, an enormous beast waddled into view around the shoulder of a ruined building. A Mon-Duel, Jason said, yelling to be heard. If it's been implanted with a Villip, the belly can function like an amplifier. It's harmless either way. Page kept his blaster rifle raised regardless. If you say so, kid, he motioned with the barrel. But you cross first. No sooner had Jason and Luke started forward than the Mon-Duel sat on its haunches with its tympanum of a belly aimed out over the canyon. In a deep and menacing voice, someone began to speak in Yuuzhan Vong. Perish, Tahiri translated. Perish, all of you who would stand between me and exaltation, who would seek to profane me in our finest moment. Shimra? Luke asked. Jason shook his head uncertainly. Could be. I battle the gods on your behalf, Tahiri continued.
and you repay me with rebellion. Perish then. Go to your deaths and your gods, while I remake the world.
Too bad we can't answer him, Mara said. We will soon enough, Luke assured her.
Jason and Tahiri walked slowly toward the seated Mon'Dul. In eerie unison, they motioned with their right arms, and the 4-metric-ton beast lowered its front legs to the ground and began to trundle off.
They're Vong sense, Luke thought.
The three young Jedi crossed the span together and turned east toward the Citadel. Ahead of them, clad in vegetation, a palisade of ruined buildings extended all the way to the western access to Shimra's mountain. Luke, Mara, and Kent had just caught up with the trio when Jason and Tahiri called everyone to a halt. Lightning flashes disclosed the presence of a group of skeletally thin humans and humanoids, dressed in dripping frayed garments and aged robeskins.
Come forward, Tahiri said in Yuuzhan Vong.
Two shamed ones approached, a male and female.
Jedi,
the young male said, his eyes fixed on Luke's thrumming lightsaber. More Yuuzhan Vong began to appear, along with a dozen or so Coruscanti, who looked as if they had been subsisting on gray weave since the occupation. The shamed and the damned, Luke told himself, as he deactivated his lightsaber. Pushing through the group came two winded and wounded human commandos who saluted Captain Page.
Back to squad, sir, the sergeant said. We've just come from down below. It's a real mess, Captain. The heretics are fighting tooth and claw, but they need reinforcements, and fast. If you can spare anyone, sir.
Page beckoned to one of his jet-packed commandos.
Congratulations, Corporal. You've been promoted to squad leader. Take 10 men and go with the sergeant.
We'll regroup at the Citadel soonest. The commando saluted, spun on his heel, and began choosing his teammates. The wounded sergeant looked from Page to Luke.
Master Skywalker, a couple of your people would make a world of difference not only to us,
he motioned to the shamed ones, but to them as well. Kent and Tahiri glanced at Luke, who nodded. Luke swung to the shamed ones who had been the first to show themselves. Have you or any of the others ever been inside the Citadel? Tahiri translated. A male in the crowd showed himself. Tahiri, ask him if Shimra is likely to be inside the Citadel, Luke said. Tahiri phrased the question and waited for the response.
He says that Shimra will be in his private coffer.
The Yuuzhan Vong aimed a thick, truncated finger at the lofty crown of the Citadel. Mara shifted her gaze from the Citadel to Luke.
Ready, soldier?
When he didn't respond immediately, she said,
what's wrong?
He held her gaze. Mara, I want you to go with Tahiri and Kenth. She almost laughed. I want you to go with them, Luke said again. Reluctantly, she nodded.
Not because I want to, but because I trust you.
Airborne at the extreme edge of the tempest that was lashing the northern quarter of the sacred precinct, the Falcon banked toward the former legislative district. Owing to the toughness of its honeycomb and crumple zone engineering, the Senate itself had survived the Yuuzhan Vong barrage. But now, the famed edifice was covered by the half-kilometer-high hemisphere that sheltered the world brain.
No mystery why we're not taking flak from plasma emplacements, Han said, as he and Leia powered the freighter through a reconnaissance flyby. Nothing short of a planet buster is going to crack that skullcap.
The auric coral has enzymatically digested and absorbed the Senate's duracrete and transparasteel,
Harar explained from the navigator's chair.
The constituent materials have been used to fashion a new exoskeleton that goes deep underground and forms an impervious sphere around the duryam, the brain.
C-3PO had a tight grip on the chair next to Harar's, and R2-D2 was securely planted behind his counterpart. Kakmame was in the dorsal gun turret. Meewaw was in the forward compartment.
How impervious? Han asked over his shoulder. Sufficient to allow the Duryam to survive an invasion as a self-contained and possibly self-propelled vessel, similar to that which constitutes the crown of the Citadel.
An escape pod, Leia said.
But massive,
Harar elaborated.
Capable not only of preserving the Duryam, with all its engineered genetics and learned skills,
but also of preserving the lives of any who happen to be in the well when the sphere launches.
Han growled and rubbed his head.
So how are we supposed to get inside the thing if you're telling me that bombs can't?
Harar leaned toward the viewport.
Complete your overflight. Let us see if we can't locate the entrance to the secret passageway Jason and Verger used to escape from the well.
As Han banked the Falcon to the west, Leia gazed at the sprawl of vegetation-clad structures below, then pointed toward the extreme southwest projection of the dome. Borsk Fela's office would have been right about there. Han sighted down her finger.
Right there, buried under who knows how many tons of Yorick Karl. There has to be another way in.
Perhaps the front door.
Yeah, we'll just go up and knock, Han said. Isn't that how you got yourself into Jabba's palace?
Actually, Captain Solo...
The front entrance may prove problematic, Harar interrupted. Continue your circle, and I'll show you why.
Lit from within by explosions and flashes of lightning, the northern horizon was a towering anvil of black clouds. Han veered east around the 2-kilometer-wide dome, and a long, elongated tunnel came into view, protruding from the dome. The hemispherical corridor appeared to be made of the interwoven branches of thousands of slender trees.
The hedge maze, Harar said. The ceremonial avenue that leads to the atrium of the well.
Han laughed.
A walk in the park, unless you're going to tell me a hedge is impervious to weapons.
The hedge is not only as solid and fire-resistant as your Durasteel, but the trees that comprise it are studded with needle-sharp thorns that range in size from that of your thumbnail to that of your arm. The thorns contain a neurotoxin potent enough to devastate the nervous system of any creature hapless enough to be pricked by them.
Han tightened his lips in frustration.
I say we see how it handles a couple of concussion missiles.
A waste of armament, Harar said. Any damage the missiles render, the Duryam will quickly repair.
Yeah, well, since you're so smart, you think of a plan to get us inside.
I already have.
How wide is your craft, Han Solo?
25 meters, give or take.
Why?
Harar took a breath.
A tight fit. But given your piloting skills, I think it can be done.
Leia swiveled her chair around to face him.
You think what can be done?
A flight through the hedge tunnel, directly to the entry portal.
Leia's jaw dropped. You can't be serious.
Princess Leia is correct,
C-3PO said.
Please confirm that your statement was in jest.
A slow grin took shape on Han's face.
He's serious. And he's right.
He looked at Leia.
We can do it.
Leia started to speak, but swallowed whatever she had in mind to say and began again.
Well, you said he'd think of something, and I guess he has.
Han patted her left arm with affection.
Better tighten up your crash webbing. You too, Goldenrod.
C-3PO canted his head in apprehension.
If it is all the same to you, sir, I'd prefer to adjourn to the forward compartment with R2.
Suit yourself, but be quick about it.
Han sent the Falcon into a broad circle, from which they emerged, staring directly down the throat of the hedge tunnel.
You're sure about this? Leia said while Han was flipping switches on the console. No, but luckily, we don't have time to think about it.
Han dropped the freighter lower and accelerated. The thorned half-circle of a mouth grew larger and larger in the viewport. Reflexively, Leia leaned back in her chair and clamped her hands on the armrests.
Hang on,
Han said, and suddenly they were inside the maze.
Fire the concussion missiles,
Han said. Leia squeezed the trigger, sending one pair, then another, streaking down the tunnel, tearing through the thorns and branches, and ultimately exploding against whatever constituted the entrance to the dome.
Angle the deflectors!
Then, suddenly, the ship broke through to a broad, wedge-shaped causeway formed by the limbs of great trees, whose leaf-bearing branches, now aflame, tangled toward the sky on either side. Han fought to keep the ship stabilized as it skidded across the former plaza and raced into the second stretch of hedge.
But the Durasteel hard branches prevailed, slowing, then snagging the spasming ship. Stalled, the Falcon came to a final rest, angled to one side, and 10 meters from the missile-damaged entrance. While two of the landing discs were in touch with the paving stones, the entire port side of the ship was upended and held fast by the interlocked branches.
"Guess this is as far as we go," Han said.
Leia, Han, and Harar freed themselves from the chairs and staggered into the ring corridor, which was strewn with objects that had found their way there from all over the ship. Han extended the landing ramp, which didn't drop far before hitting solid ground. Despite the impetus that the Prophet's rallying cry had given the heretics, the counteroffensive was not going well. Caught in a violent storm, the Shamed Ones and their newfound allies were being sliced to pieces by Kufis, knocked unconscious by Thudbugs, slashed and split by Amphistaffs. Nomanor himself was bloodied, slipping on hailstones and his own black flow as he fought with Kufi in one hand, Amphistaff in the other. Nomanor was trading strikes and stabs with a warrior a head taller than himself when he heard the clamor of running feet and raised voices. Reinforcements, Nomanor told himself bitterly. The heretics would be lucky now if they even made it to the Place of Bones. Then, blaster bolts rang out. Resistance fighters and Alliance commandos, Nomanor realized. It was the warriors who were trapped. Nomanor charged into the brawl, slashing throats and hamstrings. Overwhelmed, the warriors fought brutally and valiantly, but more and more of them were falling and being trampled underfoot. Nomanor was in the thick of things when new sounds drew his attention, and he froze in surprise and dread. He risked a sideways glance to discover 3 Jedi parrying and slashing with their lightsabers. Worse, one of them was Mara Jade Skywalker. Not far away from the red golden-haired Skywalker was Tahiri Vela, the Jedi who had almost been shaped into a Yuuzhan Vong and with whom Nomanor had fought and escaped from on Zonama Seacot. And beside Tahiri, a tall older male Jedi whom Nomanor didn't recognize. He tried to conceal himself by wading deeper into the battle, but the conflict was too frenzied for him to make any headway. Again, Nomanor heard the distinctive thrum of a lightsaber, and shortly found himself pressed shoulder to shoulder with youthful Tahiri, who was shouting alternately in Basic and Yuuzhan Vong as her blue blade deflected overhead strikes from Amphistaffs and lateral swipes from Kufis. Nomanor's attempts to squirm away were in vain. He turned his back at the same time the Jedi did, but surges in the crowd kept shoving them hard into each other. All at once, Nomanor could feel small Tahiri's body tense against his. Sending his Amphistaff flying with a force command, she immobilized him by clutching the yoke of his robe skin. Then she turned and gesticulated toward her fellow Jedi.
"Mara! I have Nomanor!"
Summoning his strength, Nomanor slashed upward with his kufi, missing Tahiri by a blade, but succeeding in cutting the handful of robe she had gripped. Crawling a sinuous and puddled path between the legs of warriors and heretics, he ultimately reached the northern edge of the Place of Hierarchy. There, where the crowd was thinner, he elbowed his way through a cluster of warriors and broke fast for the stairs and freedom. Much like the Millennium Falcon, Lady Luck had in the past 5 years undergone an atavistic transition from pleasantly appointed family craft to war vessel. But where Han's Falcon was as armed as it was fast, Lando's 50-meter-long Soro subyacht relied as ever on stealth, speed, and advanced sensor arrays that allowed it to observe and scrutinize vessels at far remove. With 3 lasers and a reinforced hull, Talon Card's Corellian transport was better configured for battle, although hardly a match for a Yuuzhan Vong task force. Which was why the 2 ships were flying at the fringe of the battle zone and leaving most of the dirty work to Errant Venture and to the Happens. Tenel Ka's flotilla had arrived moments after the Yuuzhan Vong capital ships had begun their move against Zonama Seacot and had immediately arrayed themselves in a blockade. Closer to Zonama Seacot,
flaming red errant venture, along with squadrons of X-Wings and Hapen Meteel fighters, were preying on the advanced coral skippers the task force had dispatched to test the planet's defenses. Trapped between the deep space squadrons and the atmospheric craft flown by the Jedi, the coral skippers were being decimated. And now that capital ships were involved, the planet itself had brought out its big guns, firing salvos of stunning ion fire from the summits of mountains 12 kilometers high. Equidistant from the task force and blockade, Lando and Tendra had an overview of the entire battle. But Lady Luck's seeming brazenness had made her the object of unwanted attention, and the Calrissians were being forced to do more running than spying. Their updates of enemy maneuvers had twice saved Booster Tarek from being taken by surprise, and they were a critical link in relaying intelligence between the Star Destroyer and the Jedi pilots, who at last word had finally managed to talk their living ships into returning fire. The Yuuzhan Vong gave every indication of having been thrown into disorder by their obvious miscalculation. Only total confusion could account for the fact that some of the vessels in the task force were actually turning on one of their own. The victim was the vessel that originally had been flying at the center of the Yuuzhan Vong's elongated diamond formation. It had remained at the center all through the initial coral skipper assault on Zonama Seagat, but was now being raked with plasma fire by four of the surrounding cruisers. Lando and Tendra saw the vessel split wide open, and yet, instead of exploding, the cleaved vessel released a smaller vessel that was concealed inside. A corvette analog, the six-armed craft had a scaled hull and an upraised curving stern, not unlike two vessels Errant Venture had destroyed at Kalula, a Slayer ship. Lando's blood ran cold. The ship carrying Alpha Red, Lando thought. And now, closing on Zonama Seacott. After he did so well with the Mon duel, Jaina found time to say between swings of her lightsaber. Pinned down in a grove of fingerleaf trees, 100 meters from the westernmost of the walkways that access the Citadel, Jaina and Luke were fending off streams of attack bugs that were hurtling down from lookout Ares in the Holy Mountain. Closer to Shimra's haunt, Jason was trying, without success, to pacify the beasts that were rapidly devouring the walkway itself. At least Shimra can't speak through these two, Luke said. I'd say that's exactly what Shimra's doing, Jaina hollered back. Gargantuan symbiotes, Skalru and Tuskart, were partners in the walkway devastation. Considering that the former was female and the latter male, it was something of a marriage. Absent their usual team of handlers, the creatures had emerged from a massive hollow beneath the concourse, through which the Esplanade River cascaded thunderously into the square at the base of the Citadel. Far below the concourse, at the base of the Citadel, a dark maw accessed the lower depths of the mountain, but that opening was heavily guarded by reptoid slave soldiers. With the cavernous entrance at the base of the Citadel effectively sealed, Jason saw Skalru and Tuskart as the only hope. The beasts had to be coaxed into breaching the wall of the Citadel. Jason sensed that his best chance of accomplishing this would require him to abandon the Force and give himself over fully to his Vong sense, something he had been unable to do since arriving on Coruscant. He felt like a switch being thrown between two poles, Force at one pole, Vong sense at the other. He understood further that the only way to compel Skalru and Tuskart into action was by communicating with them through the world brain. It was while aboard the seed ship that had delivered Jason and the Durium to Coruscant that they had first reached an understanding. By destroying the brain's would-be rivals, Jason had essentially determined which of several Duriams was to have the honor of transforming Coruscant into Yuuzhan Tarr. More important, he had installed a world brain whose very disposition was informed by the rapport it shared with him. All that the planet had become since then, beautiful and monstrous, delicate and coarse, symbiotic and parasitic, owed something to Jason. And yet when he reached out with his Vong sense, he again found himself in competition for the brain's attention. Some of that was due to the brain's preoccupation with Coruscant. Over and above that, there was the energy the brain was pouring into executing Shimra's requests. Abruptly, Skalru and Tuskart turned toward him, clearly under influence of the brain. Jason grasped that the moment had come for him to demonstrate his faith in the agreement he and the brain had forged. Ignoring Luke and Jaina's loud-voiced misgivings, he advanced on the coupled symbiotes. Almost immediately, his waist was encircled by two twisting appendages. Then Skalru picked him up off the demolished concourse and swung him out over the canyon, not toward the citadel, though, but as if to drop him directly into the midst of the slave soldiers and their artillery beasts. From the Falcon cockpit comlink came the sound of blaster fire and cries for help. C-3PO recognized the voice of Captain Solo.
3PO, lower the landing ramp! 3PO! 3PO!
Stiffly, C-3PO hurried to the ring corridor, where he began to pound his hand against the landing ramp switch.
Oh, it's no use. The Thorn Hedge has the Millennium Falcon in a deathlock. Captain Solo and the Princess will die, and we'll be imprisoned like museum exhibits.
R2-D2 tootled an encouraging phrase, and C-3PO ceased his pounding to stare at him.
You can do what? Reroute power from the deflector shield to send a charge through the hull?
C-3PO's hands flew up once again.
Well, why didn't you say so earlier?
Shuffling back to the juncture of the ring and outrigger corridors, C-3PO placed himself where he could peer through the forward viewport, as well as keep a photoreceptor on his counterpart. The olfactory sensor at the top of C-3PO's chest monitored smells of ozone and singed wood.
It's working, R2,
he shouted.
The Thorn Hedge is retracting. Thank the Maker. We're free.
R2-D2 squawked a question.
Yes, of course you should lower the landing ramp,
C-3PO said as he hurried for it.
The sooner we leave this ship, the better.
Skidding through a left-hand turn, he stepped onto the canted ramp just as its foot was striking the paving stones of the plaza. At the foot of the ramp stood Captain Solo, staring wide-eyed at something off to his left, at which he began firing. Princess Leia, Cacmame, and Miwal were hastening up the ramp, all but crawling when they reached the body of the dead Yuuzhan Vong.
3PO, get ready to close the ramp,
Captain Solo yelled. He fired off several blaster bolts, then ducked a hurled amphistaff and threw himself onto the ramp.
Close it!
But sir...
Leia, get into the cockpit! Raise the ship!
Captain Solo was still bellying up the ramp when a sudden growth spurt sent the branches through the gap between the starboard docking arm and the ramp, preventing it from elevating entirely. Into the gap grew long, thick thorns.
They're lethal!
Harar shouted.
R2!
C-3PO said.
Charge the hull again!
Another electrical charge shot through the hull. The vines withdrew, and the ramp lowered to the paving stones.
R2, no!
C-3PO yelled. Cacmame and Miwal did what they could to keep a group of warriors from entering the ship, but after shooting the first half a dozen, they were overwhelmed, disarmed, and pinned to the deck. Han shot a few more as they raced into the ring corridor, but reinforcements kept coming, backing him and Leia toward the forward compartment. Some warriors had the foresight to run through the Falcon and enter the main cabin space from the port side. Pressed against the Dejarik table, with his blaster in one hand and his other gripping Leia's shoulder, Han dodged lashes and amphistaffs and thrusts from Kufis, but he refused to yield until at last one of the warriors managed to press the tip of his serpentine weapon to Leia's throat. Then, grimacing, he dropped his blaster arm to his side in a gesture of surrender.
All right, you've got us,
he said to the advancing warriors. I'm sure we can work something out. Moments later, a female Yuuzhan Vong, with a crest of tentacles and an eight-fingered right hand, edged through the tight press of warriors in the forward compartment. On seeing her, R2-D2 loosed a prolonged and mournful whistle. C-3PO nodded his head.
You're right, R2. A shaper.
The shaper appraised Han and Leia, then turned to one of her warriors. C-3PO understood her to say, "Gather their weapons and bring everyone out of the vessel." Mara heard Tahiri call that she had found Noma Noor. buried in the ferocious tangle of heretics and warriors, and even while dodging amphistaffs and kufis, Mara had had to stand on the crumpled body of a warrior to see him. The look hadn't lasted long, just long enough for her to see the fear in his eye. Then he was gone, slithering his way through the crowd. Taking a moment to touch Tahiri and Kent through the Force, Mara vaulted from the steps to the high platform of a temple, then dropped down to the ground and raced after Nomanor, her lightsaber close at hand to deal with anyone who might try to stand in her way. Rushing into the square, she stopped to scan the several exits and again spotted her quarry disappearing around the toppled end of a high wall. The pursuit led downward into darker levels where fetid water dripped from cracked ceilings, and the only light was that which found its way down through gaps in the crushed buildings and the riotously verdant areas that now roofed them. Breathing hard and stumbling more often, Nomanor was beginning to tire. Mara's acute hearing told her that much, and more. As she was kicking down a final door, she heard a hand blaster's safety click off and entered the room to discover Nomanor hiding behind the putrid remains of a Twi'lek, still dressed in security guard garb. Mara used the Force to call her lightsaber to hand, even as Nomanor was triggering off the first bolts. Her blade deflected one after the next, until he emptied the blaster of fuel. He had sense enough not to hurl the depleted weapon at her. Instead, he began to scrabble backward on the palms of his hands and feet, his gaze riveted on her as she advanced, calm but coldly fixed on her prey. A wall brought an abrupt end to his retreat. Growling, kufi in hand, he began to slash wildly at her, the lightsaber notwithstanding. She leapt backward out of reach, then deactivated the blade and encouraged him to charge. Her hands moved in a dexterous blur as she deflected his knife blows and got inside his frantic movements to slap and tap him in the chest or the jaw, never hard enough to stun him, let alone incapacitate him, but driving him backward with each smack. Ducking his increasingly desperate lunges and crosscuts, she swept his feet out from under him with a circling sidekick, then allowed him to come to his feet only long enough for her to cripple his knee with the toe of her right boot. He flung himself at her, but she sidestepped his headlong rush and sent him hurtling into a wall. Her blows were beginning to do damage. She pivoted on her left foot and kicked him hard with her right, forcing the wind from him. He dropped to his knees, his right hand pressed to his chest. He had trouble getting to his feet, but when he did, she sent him down again with a fist to the face. Dread shone in his real eye. He backed away from her until his back was pressed to a wall. Then he sank slowly to his knees. Mara ignited her lightsaber and held it with the tip low and to her right. One upward swing and she could send his head 5 meters. Nomanor bent at the waist and pressed his face to the littered floor in a posture of servility.
"You've defeated me, Mara Jade Skywalker," he said without lifting his head. "I beg for mercy."
When she made no immediate reply, he risked raising his face to her, and when he saw that she hadn't moved forward, he continued.
"What would killing me accomplish now? Yes, it will satisfy you. But will it put an end to the war?"
"For the moment, I'll content myself with satisfaction," she told him. Mara took another step, raising her lightsaber.
"I can help!" he screamed. "I've changed! You saw me leading the Shamed Ones, just as you do. I want to see the war ended."
She brought the glowing blade of the lightsaber close to his neck, then deactivated it and clipped a handle to her belt. "If you really wanted to put an end to the war, you shouldn't have interfered at Zonama Seacot."
"I was only trying to spare the planet," Nomanor said. "Even now, Shimra is out to destroy it. He believes it was given to the Jedi by the gods as a means of testing our worthiness. He claims to have a poison capable of killing Zonama Seacot."
Alpha Red, Mara realized in anguish. She grabbed Nomanor by the shoulder and shoved him toward the closest exit from the building. "You're going to show me you're deserving of the extra time I've given you." Echoing the shape of the worldship Citadel, Shimra's coffer, His bunker in the crown of the fortress was a huge vaulted space with polished walls and stately columns. From the eastern side of its circular floor, a stairway of Yorick coral spiraled into an upper level, where some said resided the controls that could launch the summit of the citadel into space, in much the same way as the Well of the World Brain could be launched, to ensure that the Supreme Overlord and the Duryam survived, no matter what befell the rest of the Yuuzhan Vong and their multitude of Byots. Shimra's Slayer bodyguards were with him, as was Anami, perhaps the only shamed one on Yuuzhan Tar, or any other occupied world, still content to curl at the feet of the elite. A shaper doubled as a Villip mistress to make certain that the Supreme Overlord didn't miss a moment of the devastation he had called down on the planet. The shaper stepped forward from her Villip choir.
Dreadlord, High Priest Jaqen reports that saboteurs have been seized at the Well of the World Brain. Apparently, the priest Harar is among them.
Harar,
Anami said, then caught himself and hunkered down.
Assuming that it meets with your blessing, Dreadlord, the shaper said, the prisoners will be prepared for sacrifice.
With all speed, set to it,
Shimra said.
Join them there. Let us give the guards their last ounce of flesh before we dispense with them.
Muffled explosions punctuated the silence as the shaper exited. The coffer trembled as the enemy's aerial bombardment continued. Admitted into the bunker, a wounded warrior in Bondoon crab armor saluted and began to stagger toward the throne. He didn't make it halfway before he collapsed onto his knees, black blood curdled in a wound to his right armpit.
Lord, he began weakly, enemy warriors have surrounded the citadel, and even now are attempting to battle their way inside.
Shimra approached the warrior to have a closer look at his wound.
No blaster made that injury.
Three Jedi, Lord, at the western gate.
Let the Jedi come to us.
He looked at Anami.
After all, diversion needn't be the exclusive province of the War Master.
What had been the atrium of the Senate was now a cold cavern of living Yorick coral. Their hands shackled behind their backs by pincered Byots, Leia, Han, Harar, Kakmame, and Meewal were being ushered by a cadre of warriors toward the 5-meter-wide tunnel opposite the atrium's front entry. C-3PO and R2-D2 trailed behind, the protocol droid's leg joints squeaking, and the astromech's retractable tread also in need of lubrication. High Priest Jaqen's acolytes were doing a rush job of purifying the captives by wafting smoke from elaborate sensors and anointing everyone with finger-flung drops of a pungent-smelling liquid. Nearby walked Master Shaper Keela Quad and High Prefect Rathul, whom Harar had explained presided over Vong Form Coruscant. Red-orange light pulsed brightly from the far end of the tunnel. According to Jason, the round-topped corridor extended almost half a kilometer to what had been the Great Rotunda, and was now the Well of the World Brain. A clamor began to build from somewhere outside the atrium's missile-torn entry. As the procession came to a halt, Leia could discern the sounds of running feet and dozens of voices raised in conviction. The cadre of warriors shoved the captives to one side, whirled, and fanned out across the cavern. All eyes were on the entry, when a crowd of scrawny Yuuzhan Vong began to pour into the cavern from the hedge-lined causeway, shouting demands and brandishing crude weapons. Shamed ones, Leia realized. Heretics. Shamed ones continued to squeeze into the atrium, ultimately massing into a mob 50 strong, but taking no action against the marshaled warriors. Clearly appalled by the intrusion, Jaqen hurried forward, raising his thin arms over his head, as if about to call on the power of the gods to smite the crowd. Standing alongside Leia, Harar translated the High Priest's words.
Jaqen is demanding to know who or what inspired them to profane this most sacred of places. He's ordering them to leave or be killed where they stand.
Individuals began to edge their way to the front of the crowd. A battered Yuuzhan Vong male limped forward, shorter than many of his comrades and wearing a shredded robeskin. The shamed ones quieted long enough for their apparent spokesperson to make a brief statement. Leia saw Harar's eyes widen in disbelief.
He declares himself to be the Prophet.
The priest glanced at Leia.
It's Nomanor.
Leia traded astonished looks with Han, while the shamed ones went back to shouting and gesturing with their weapons. Just as the tension was culminating, sounds of another commotion infiltrated the cavern.
Reinforcements!
But in place of boisterous cries came a repetitive chant, and in place of the determined shuffling of bare feet came the cadence of sandaled troops. A murmur of confusion swept through the heretic crowd. Expressions of fervor became looks of sudden concern. Whatever chance there had been for victory vanished. Jaqen, Drathul, and Keela Quad relaxed somewhat as the menacing detachment formed up parallel to Drathul's line of warriors, facing the entry and the quailing heretics. Fixing Nomanor with a menacing gaze, Drathul pushed through the double row of warriors and paced down the line until he reached the commander of the reinforcements.
Stay your hand when it comes to dispatching Prefect Nomanor, his subalterns, and the three Jedi, the High Prefect said. We'll want to add them to our offerings to the World Brain.
The commander snapped his fists to his shoulders in salute. When Drathul had returned to a safe position behind his warriors, the commander issued an order, and as one entity, the reinforcements performed a synchronous about-face, uttered a battle cry, and attacked, turning their amphistaffs and thudbugs against Drathul's forces. It took a moment for the shamed ones to realize what was happening. Then they pealed in triumph and rushed forward to lend their meager arms to the fray.
Mark this as the moment the war truly turned,
Harar said to Leia in a resigned voice. With the guards occupied, R2-D2 rolled up behind Kakmame and Miwal and used his laser to stun the creatures that secured their wrists. Once freed, the Nogri immediately moved Han and Leia out of the line of fire. C-3PO and R2-D2 followed, the astromech anxious to laser the pincer bionts manacling Han and Leia as well. Leia whirled to see the Master Shaper disappearing through the archway that led to the Well of the World Brain. When the reptoid slave soldiers, crowded at the base of the Citadel, realized that Serpentine Skowru was not going to drop Jason into their midst, but merely hold on to him until Tuskart completed knocking an opening in the western wall, they made the mistake of taking out their fury on the beasts themselves by peppering them with razor and thudbugs and fire jelly grenades. Seeing others of their kind attacked, the claw-footed artillery beasts that had been spewing plasma into the Glatani Esplanade Canyon shambled through a turn and charged at the Chazrak, trampling dozens before any could escape back into the maw at the base of the Citadel. But the reptoids found no safety even there, as the enraged beasts pursued them inside, and the sound of the Chazrak's cries resonated in the air. Luke and Jaina rushed to the edge of the demolished walkway and hurled themselves into the ragged breach Tuskart's stubby forelegs had opened, and in which Jason had been safely deposited by Skowru. That still left the problem of how to reach Shimra's bunker. But it didn't take the Jedi long to discover a narrow stairway that hugged the Citadel's curved perimeter as it wound toward the summit. Luke led the ascent, with Jaina close behind, and Jason a few steps behind her, silently thanking the World Brain for interceding at the western walkway, and reaffirming his promise to end the Duryam's inner turmoil. It wasn't until the 8th level that Luke and his niece and nephew met with resistance. But it was clear from the ferocity with which the warriors attacked, from above, below, and through the various access corridors, that the onslaught was likely to continue all the way to Shimra's lair, and probably inside it as well. In most places, the stairway wasn't wide enough for the two people to stand abreast, and in those stretches, Luke had to face the brunt of the attacks. He was his own vortex, deflecting amphistaff strikes, whip-like lashes, and spurts of deadly venom. Dodging or redirecting flights of thudbugs, parrying the thrusts of Koofies, to sidestep, duck, maneuver his body in ways that seemed to defy gravity. On the 14th level, where the Citadel's exterior wings sprouted from the hull, they reached a fork in the stairway. Luke swung to Jason. Which way? He wasn't even breathing heavily. Jason extended his Vong sense. The left passage leads to living quarters on the next level. The other, to some sort of Dovin basal lift that accesses the summit. He screwed his eyes shut. Shimra is there. Once more they began to race up the stairway, dropping, then leaping over the bodies of wounded or dead warriors. Tapping deeper into his Vong sense, Jason again reached out for the Duryam, only to be staggered by what he felt in return. The brain was even more confused than before, by something else now. It felt threatened, concerned for its survival, and for what might become of its creation, Yuuzhan Tar, should the brain be killed or forced to flee the planet. Jason stretched out with the force. Mom and Dad, he realized. And Mara, Tahiri, and Kenth. They had fought their way into the well and were preparing to destroy the Duryam with explosives. The brain felt betrayed. It sent to Jason that it should have killed him when it had him in its grips years earlier. It should have dragged him into the well and let him drown. It should have ordered Skowru to kill him. Either you're going to change its mind, or we're going to change it, Han told Kila Quad. His right hand held one of the thermal detonators he had retrieved, his thumb close to the orb's trigger. He waited for Harar to translate the warning, then added, There's no two ways around this. The three of them, along with Leia, Mara, Noma Noor, and the droids, were standing on a trembling 10-meter diameter platform that overlooked the Well of the Worldbrain. A colossal bowl of Yorick coral that climbed more than halfway to the vaulted roof of what had been the Great Rotunda. The battle was continuing in the atrium, but it was mostly a mop-up operation. A sulfurous mist overlaid the Duryam pool, within which moved the bloated, fleshy black monstrosity Han and Leia had come to conciliate or kill. Recalling what Harar had said about the well actually being a self-contained sphere, capable of surviving even the destruction of Coruscant, Han couldn't help feeling that the entire quaking structure was either about to explode or lift off. Han glanced at the Shaper, then Harar. What's it going to be? The Shaper composed herself and leaned over the pool. Sweat began to bead her trestled brow, then fall into the agitated pool. Almost immediately, the Duryam breached the surface, a yellow eye as big as a starfighter glaring up at those on the platform. Then its mate appeared, blinking and fixing on everyone. A spray of powerful tentacles surrounding the creature's mouth sliced through the humid air faster than Han's eye could follow. Then all at once, the well stopped shaking, and the Duryam grew quiescent. Two of the longer tentacles stretched out to touch Kila Quad, then Harar, in what seemed a display of submission or compliance. The Shaper and the priest traded looks of incredulity.
It's as pliant as a young Yamask, Harar said.
Han thumbed the grenade's arming trigger forward. Leia blew out her breath in relief.
Jason talked to it.
Kila Quad ridiculed the idea.
If anyone convinced the Duryam to yield, it was the Supreme Overlord. He knows that whatever you do here won't matter, because we will have proved our worthiness, and the gods will rid this galaxy of all infidels.
Harar shook his head ruefully.
If the gods judged us by our military might, they would never have banished us from paradise.
The Shaper sniffed in derision.
This war will take care of itself. We prove our worth by destroying Zonama Seacult.
She held Harar's gaze.
It is not long for this galaxy, Eminence. The Supreme Overlord discovered a way to poison it.
Shimra lies, Harar said.
Mara shoved Nomanor forward. The Shaper's right, she said in a grim voice. Noma Noor can explain. At Zonama Seacount, the battle had reached a fevered pitch. Because his fighter was without display screens of any sort, Kip was left to imagine the intense fighting. But Lando had painted a vivid picture when he had calmed Kip from errant venture. Booster Star Destroyer had been forced to retreat, with both Lady Luck and Wildcard back on board, and six Smugglers Alliance ships unaccounted for. Word that the enemy vessel, contaminated with Alpha Red, had been spotted flying with the original task force, had placed the Jedi on the offensive. Defending close to the surface, Kip would no sooner conclude one duel than another would present itself. As had so often happened in previous battles, the Yuuzhan Vong were slowly gaining the upper hand through sheer determination and the strength of numbers. Whether the unrelenting assault echoed the will of the individual pilots, or the resoluteness of the controlling Yamask, the invaders were finding soft spots and creating openings to assure that the Alpha Red poisoned craft would reach the surface intact. Kip was drawing on his ship's extraordinary speed to intercept a pair of coral skippers, when a sudden coolness enveloped his right hand, the hand that the control console had encompassed, and was in fact his interface with the ship. Almost instantly, the fighter began to shed velocity and grow unresponsive. Kip pressed the control stick trigger. Though the launchers were far from depleted, they refused to fire. Then Kip realized that it wasn't only his ship that had powered down. Throughout the fire-fractured sky, other Sakotan ships were abbreviating their duels. The comlink grew noisy with reports from Korin, Zek, Lobaka, and Saba, confirming that their fighters, too, were no longer responding.
"The craft Lando reported seeing at Kalula could have been a decoy,"
Korin said to Kip over the comlink.
"The Alpha Red vessel could have already crashed on the surface."